This felt to me like when you go see a show and occasionally the tech has to come up and play a few riffs in order to make sure the guitar is working and that the sound check.
Welcome to another episode of 1001 Album Complaints, the show where lifelong friends, musicians, and persnickety aficionados get together to tell the backstory behind history's most classic albums, as outlined in Robert Dimery's book, 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. We are going to give some history on this band. We're going to give our opinions. We're going to offer lots of musical commentary along the way as we play clips from specific songs. So don't worry if you haven't heard this album yet or lately, we'll get you up to speed right quick. And in the end, we are going to vote on whether or not you actually needed to hear this record before you died. Now listen, we're fans of music and we're musicians ourselves. We respect the craft and we respect anyone who engages with it in any serious way. However, when musicians are throwing back a few together or taking that long van ride from Reno to Salt Lake City, we like to nitpick. We like to complain, even about the music we love. It's fun to have some laughs about the choices that artists make, especially in the studio. So fair warning, we're going to be poking some good-natured fun at this band. I can guarantee it.
I actually propose the next album that any of us comes out with, we should let fans roast it in order to get a taste of our own medicine.
Hey, nice.
I like to think it's better than a roast, but yes, I like it conceptually, Alan. I agree. But I just feel like I'm glad we have that disclaimer about it being good-natured, because it does come from a place of love and respect for people who are even engaging with this thing. We all know on this call how hard it is to make something good. But okay, so today we're going to be diving into a rather modern album and therefore a relatively recent addition to Robert Dimery's esteemed tome, a record from 2013 that one reviewer called a seamless fusion of emotive theatrics, hook-loaded songwriting, and some of the more forward-thinking sonics in electronic music right now.
Wow.
That's right. You guessed it. That pretentious asshole works for Pitchfork Music. And of course, I am talking about the Scottish electropop band called Churches with a V and their debut album, The Bones of What You Believe. To get everyone situated where our headspace is right now, what we've been listening to for the last week, let's play a clip of the song Lies, the first song that the world heard from this band way back in 2012. Faster, faster, you won't go far. Shouldn't leave, feeling faint. We both know why. You've got to show me both knees, cold eye line. Hold me slowly, hide me so I can fall ways. We can sing, we can make time. Old songs, blood and flame. You could be mine, but you've got to show me. And now that you have a taste of the genre of the music that we're going to be talking about tonight, I'd love to introduce our panelists for the evening by way of a tweet-length review. So let's throw it around the room and get everyone's short, encapsulated review of how your week went. We're going to kick it first to Adam.
First off, persnickety. I think the only other time I've ever heard that used was in a cheese commercial. So well done, Rob, on being the second time I've ever heard it used. Well done. But this is Adam, and for this week's tweet, I want to quote John Hughes, which I think is appropriate given that nearly every track on this album sounds like the outro of an 80s action comedy, and that is, the best sounds a kid will get is in a movie theater with huge speakers turned up loud. And I quote that because listening to this album on headphones versus big loud speakers is a completely different experience, an experience that will make you realize that, like me, you're probably a secret synth pop fan.
Ooh, love it. Let's keep this train rolling and kick it over to Alan.
Hey, this is Alan here, and there's a line in one of the songs that we'll discuss at some point this evening, and the line goes, "Give me something to remember you by." I really wish they had taken their own advice when they made this album, because I came away remembering very little about what I had just listened to.
Wow. Gonna be a combative one tonight. I can tell. Let's send it over to Phil.
I want to give a second to my man Oren from last week. He got a little free rant in my head this week. I've been thinking about Countdown to Ecstasy a little too much. I'm not here to back down on my position, but I respect your opinion, Oren. And I want to say that My Old School is my favorite Steely Dan guitar solo. Love to fight the fade.
Wait, someone getting you to think about Steely Dan was an accomplishment? I don't...
Last but not least, I want to give it a little bit of time up front. If you like this record, you got to check out an American band by the name of Teen Men, my man Nick Krill, a very similar sort of indie electro pop. This would be right up your alley. Anyway, my tweet length review. I am old. This isn't bad. This is better than garbage, as in Shirley Manson's garbage.
Nice. Oh,
that's nice. Pretty good. I like it.
And this is Rob. I'm here to walk us down Church's road here and tell the backstory of this band. And I actually wrote two short tweet length reviews for tonight. Maybe I can try both of them. The first is synth pop for millennials who just can't sit still. And the second one, maybe you'll like this one better, is we get it. You tried Molly. It was great.
Oh, I would have loved to be on Molly listening to this.
We're going to get into the backstory of this band. We're going to tell their history. And I learned a lot of interesting things I'm excited to impart to you. And I think, as always, that context is going to help us ultimately appreciate and levy judgment upon this record. But first, I would love to get deeper on the general impressions from you guys. Tell me more about how the week went. And I would like to hear a positive comment first from Adam.
Yeah. So first thing, so the singer does not do the classic girl millennial thing, which I call Novocaine jaw. If you go back and listen to our Lord episode, the opening line of her opening track on that, she says the word bar and car, but they come out as ball and claw. The singer on this album does not have any affectations. She just has a beautiful voice. And so I dug that. And Alan, I was where you were about 3 days ago. And the more I let this run on repeat, the more it buried its way into my head. And there's a couple tracks that stand out as those earworms that I was humming in the shower last night.
I'm so glad you said that, Adam, because you took the words right out of my brain. I went on a roller coaster this week. When I first put it on, I'd never heard this album before. When I first put it on, I was like, it's fun, easy, upbeat, but perhaps not super memorable, but okay. Then after a few more listens, I came into my, how many permutations of the Knight Rider soundtrack does one need in their lives phase? But then in the waning hours of the week, I got the listens in. Like you said, I think pop music, it's a hallmark of pop music that it really needs to worm its way in there with multiple listens. And it can be one of the drawbacks of our weekly show that we don't have a long time to sink in. So as I got those listens in, and more importantly even, once I got out there and I exercised, I moved around while listening to this music, it started to really sink in and I came back to a very positive outlook. Now, does that mean it's essential? I don't know yet, but I'm coming in positive for sure, despite my snarky tweets.
I felt the way that you both felt at times. And so that was my biggest issue with it, was I feel like it had moments. We'll talk about the tracks, the first track on the album, absolute banger. And so my hopes were really high. And obviously there's a reason why people stack their best song as the lead off track. It makes perfect sense because oftentimes, you know, there's not a lot after that. But I found it just disappointing in general. Like, clearly, just to be perfectly obvious, this is not my genre and probably not most of us here, given our sort of alleged rockist leanings. But I can still appreciate it when an album really nails what it's trying to do, even if it's not my thing. And I just didn't find any one thing particularly compelling. I thought that at times the vocals really soared. At times there were nice, expansive pop hooks, which I do like in general. And again, there's a couple legit bangers on here. But other times I felt like it was just kind of there, and I felt like the songwriting was hit or miss. The synth, I don't hate synth inherently, but I hate it now.
It's a lot. I will give that to you. It is a lot of synth, obviously.
The production is very busy, and that is where some of my complaints will come in. They don't often know how to let the production breathe. And when they do, I think it really creates great effect on the songs.
Yeah.
I think that's really well said. I think if they let me back into the studio with the tapes, yeah. You know? The main thing is that I don't think there's any real drums on the record, or if there are, they're heavily, heavily processed and probably behind the click, essentially. I feel like there's a couple songs where, like, if there was just an element that was more natural, like they would breathe more.
Yeah, I think the main natural element holding it down is Lauren Mayberry's voice. Absolutely. Right. And certainly the songs that she's not on are weighed down by her not being on them. I think we're going to talk about that. But I think altogether, it was actually a fun and fairly memorable bit of pop music. That's what I came away with. And to be honest, in the end, I found it to have a little bit of an ecstatic quality. Like, I don't think they named their band Churches for any religious reasons. But somehow that name started to make sense. And maybe it's the tranciness of the unrelenting synth bass and drum patterns, or the heavy reverb of the vocals. But there's like a little bit of hypnotism going on here. And I like it. And even though this is not technically my genre, as Alan said, nor is it any of our primary genres, I think the record will show that I am a huge fan of pop. I want to like pop music. I want it to be interesting and layered, and I want to understand the stories behind it that help me appreciate it better. I do think a lot of it is schlocky, but when it's good, I'm excited.
I think you're hitting on already some of what I think are the issues of it, frankly, where when I listen to pop music, it doesn't have to hit me over the head with hooks and catchiness. Like, I don't think that's a always necessary element, but I do expect, you know, some ear candy, and I just didn't think there was enough of it. I think there were times where I was like, oh, that was dope, but that was so outweighed by what I felt like was a lot of baggage on the album, and I just didn't feel like you are pop first. I just expect a bit more accessibility and a bit more that I can hang my hat to. And there was just something about it that I can't really put my finger on it, but it just left me kind of wanting a little bit.
That's interesting, because I was thinking too about a quote from the Bonnie Raitt episode, and the guy who produced that killer Bonnie Raitt episode said that all of these songs, regardless of what they are, they have to work with just Bonnie Raitt and a guitar. Because that was her thing. She was going out and touring with just a guitar. And I was thinking to myself, is there a version of these that go over if you were to remove the 800 layers of synth and just put her on stage with a guitar player, an acoustic guitar player, would these songs work? And I think a majority of them would. I think the melodies are compelling enough. And even some of the sappy lyrics, you know, a lot of it's, you know, people leaving you and you're losing your love, but they're written that they're not super obvious. Like, it's a little deep.
The lyrics are interesting, an interesting point, and especially I think the way this like ties into the pop topic. Like, yeah, a week's not enough time, right? Unless it really moves you to sort of like get into the characters and to get into, you know, some of the storylines that are or are not there. I did think the record was fun, or at least the songs with the female leads. Like, that does seem to be the clear dividing line on the record, right? Is that like her voice is moving and it works with the synth very well. Whereas like his songs are just a little less exciting.
They're weak.
At least at first glance. And maybe there's more there and I just didn't get to it yet. Convince me.
Well, I want to circle back to something that Adam said. You're hitting on already some things that jumped out to me when I listened to it. I also wanted to figure out how would these songs stand alone if you strip them down to their essence. And when I saw that they did a Tiny Desk concert like 10 years ago, I was like, oh shit, like this is cool. Like, I'll get to see exactly what you're referring to. But it was still the guys banging on synths. And
it was still a lot of synth, yeah. There's like four samplers and modulators and yeah.
And the one guy's literally, you can't see, but it's just like, da-da-da-da. Having said that, though, I think they picked the songs that I really like on this album. And so that experience was actually, it did prove your point, which is that even stripped down to their essence, those were good songs. I just didn't think there were enough of them.
Okay, all right.
Two quick points, and then I want to get into the background, and of course we can keep talking about it and offering our opinions. One is, we must have been friends for a long time, Adam, because not only did I think that exact thought that was just mentioned about will these songs stand alone, but I went and tested that theory on the piano on a couple of these songs, and I found that they really did work for me. I like a couple of these melodies, and I'm going to try to work them a little harder and maybe even put them in my repertoire. My home repertoire, I mean, not for a set list, right? I also watched the Tiny Desk concert, and I thought it was fun, and I thought it was cool. Sometimes, as someone who doesn't listen to a lot of electronically produced music, one can get to thinking that a band like this goes on stage and just hits play on a tape recorder, and that's most of it. And that was definitely not the case, and the Tiny Desk concert, I think, showcased that. So they are a band in that sense, even though they are all playing synthesizers and or drum machines. But I want to make another point about the pop music angle. I think this is a story about two different but important things. Musically, I think it's a story about very, very, very simple elements, simple chords, simple melodies, and simple ideas. But when strung together, I think all of them are pretty strong and the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. But the other thing I want to point out is this is pop music made outside the pop machine. On all these country records, we always talk about people leaving Nashville, rebelling against the Nashville system of how pop music gets made. What I kept thinking about this week was these songs could be Katy Perry songs or someone
totally.
Like that.
Totally.
In a positive way, right? But instead, it's made by this independent rock band. For the most part, an independent rock band with that aesthetic. And I think that's just an inherently interesting idea. Now, again, am I saying it's absolutely essential to your listening? Not yet, but I grew in my appreciation and understanding through some of these aspects of the story.
That's an interesting angle that I hadn't really considered. I kept coming back to Taylor Swift, and maybe it's just because that's what's being played in my house. I've got young kids, and so I'm hearing that often.
Here.
And so I kept coming back to that. I didn't pick up on like the Katy Perry aspect of it, but there were times where I felt like, are they just trying to do like a Taylor Swift thing? But I think your context is really interesting that I hadn't considered, which is working that outside of that whole Max Martin, like pop factory sort of thing. Yeah. I think that's cool.
They're not working with the Swedes. They're not working with Pharrell.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, so let's talk about the background of this band. Churches are from Glasgow, Scotland, and this story kind of weaves through all of the Glasgow music scene of the early 2000s. And in case you don't know, there are actually quite a lot of bands you might know that started in Glasgow. For it being a relatively small city, only about 500,000 people, a lot of bands have come out of there. Bands like Bell and Sebastian, Franz Ferdinand, Camera Obscura, The Blue Nile, Mogwai, Primal Scream, The Vaseline's, and my favorite, Delamitri, who scored a hit in the U.S. in the 90s.
Look around the world, pretty.
Yes, dude.
Whoa.
We could do an entire episode on that song. There's a stacked harmony in the pre-chorus.
I hope that's the song you're referring to that I just started singing.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Pop perfection. It's like a minute and 58 seconds long. All right. Sorry, Rob.
No, that's the reaction I wanted to get because I didn't know he was Scottish or that band was Scottish. I don't even know if it's a person or a band, to be honest. The point is, Glasgow is a hopping musical scene. It has been really for decades. But our story with Churches starts back in the early 2000s when a guy called Ian Cook meets a fella called Martin Daugherty at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. Some places seem to say they were both students, both studying music. That seems plausible. But I also read that this guy Martin Daugherty was a student in a class where Ian Cook was lecturing. And he wore a PJ Harvey shirt to class, and that prompted a conversation that they got to talking. Now, I should mention that there's kind of a big age difference. Ian Cook is 8 years older than Martin Daugherty. So that story kind of makes a little more sense, but maybe he was a TA. I'm not sure. Either way, they met at university.
He was buying him beer.
He was buying him beer, exactly. This is way back in 2003. Daugherty is 19. Oh, I think the legal drinking age in Scotland is probably 11.
Yeah, I was going to say right.
Daugherty's 19, and he's in a band at the time called Julia 13. And he asks Cook, Ian Cook, who's the elder person, to help produce their EP. They're an inexperienced band. They don't know anything about recording. They couldn't afford microphones or studio time. And by the way, I listened to some of it. They sound a bit like Ben's era Radiohead, which is to say guitar-driven rock music with whiny male vocals. Now, that's kind of how they connect initially. Ian Cook helps them record that EP. The band breaks up shortly after, doesn't really go anywhere, but they've met, they've connected. This guy, Ian Cook, he's also in a band, a much more established one at the time. He's the guitar player in this band called Aerogram, and they actually released 4 full-length albums and do pretty well by most metrics. And by the way, they sound like noisy, shoegazy, guitar-driven indie rock with whiny male vocals.
I see a theme here.
Good, good.
There's a theme right. Developing, right? This is early 2000s Glasgow.
That checks out.
Aerogram had a fair amount of success. They toured America a few times. They had some buzz back around this time, 2003, right around when these two were meeting up. And unfortunately, they released these records. They never quite fully caught on or took off by the time they made it back to tour America again. In 2007, they had hired this younger guy, Martin. These are both members of churches, but they haven't formed churches yet. They hired him as a touring keyboard player. But unfortunately, they played to much smaller crowds, and basically the band was in the midst of breaking up. So this was sort of the genesis of their collaboration. They meet in 2003. They start collaborating when he gets hired as the younger guy gets hired as a touring keyboard player in 2007. And all their bands at this point are kind of broken up. Now, as a side note, with a small personal connection and, surprisingly, a callback already earlier in the episode. After Aerogram breaks up in 2007, Martin Daugherty gets hired in a similar hired gun for touring only role in a band called The Twilight Sad, another Scottish band. And he claims that the wildest, most debaucherous time of his life was touring America with them and yet another Scottish band. Now, stay with me here. That band was called Frightened Rabbit. And they were riding some indie buzz from their record, Midnight Organ Flight. And I bring this up because...
Yeah, my boy Nick Krill was in the Spinto band, who was on tour with Frightened Rabbit, probably right around the same time, maybe a little earlier than that, 2008-ish?
2008.
Yeah.
Same time. Yeah. And we played with them. Phil's missing the biggest part. We played a show with those two bands.
I was just trying to leave that to you.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
We play with them.
So you basically shared a stage with the guy from the band tonight.
Well, no, it's sort of a 6 degrees of separation thing. My point is that apparently in the midst of these most debaucherous Scottish guys on tour, Frightened Rabbit seems to have cordoned themselves off, played a smaller scale show with the likes of us, The Chop, and our friends in the Spinto band, who were already referenced because one of their lead singers, Nick Krill, is a good friend of Phil's. And he now has a band called Teen Men that Phil referenced earlier in the episode. So check all those bands out.
Oh, that's cool.
Thought that was kind of fun that we caught them somewhere in the middle. I'm sure we did not keep up with the Scottish drinking that was going on otherwise.
Ooh, that'd be a tough order to keep.
Challenge accepted.
But okay. So this guy, Martin Daugherty, he's touring with these other bands. He's getting work as a musician. He's in his early 20s. And at some point, he just realizes that playing someone else's songs is inherently less interesting than playing one's own. You get it, right? Okay, but back to Ian Cook for a second. Picture it. You were in a band. You got signed by a successive handful of indie labels. They kind of switch labels for each of their 4 full-length releases. You tour all through America a couple times on their dime. This is more success by several miles than one could realistically dream of as a young musician.
Sure.
What I'm trying to get across here is that was your shot. When Aerogram breaks up, Ian Cook is in his early 30s. And he's like, that was it. I tried. It almost worked, or really it did work, but now it's over with. So I'm just going to hang around Glasgow and I'm going to produce other bands.
I thought you were going to say get a job at Guitar Center, which is another potential option.
He's done the smart, this is the intelligent musician's retirement plan, which is he's been setting up his home studio the entire time. He's been learning about engineering.
Yeah.
Our friend Nick Krill has taken a similar path, we should point out. And anyway, he does that for a few years, helping out local bands because it is a rich scene. And in 2011, a band called Blue Sky Archives ask him for help with their record. And they are yet another guitar-driven Scottish indie rock band.
Crowded scene, man. Crowded scene. Oof.
I know. Except this band has a female vocalist called Lauren Mayberry. Now, you might be noticing that in this thriving Glasgow scene of the early 2010s, there aren't really many synth-led projects. Everything is guitars, fuzzy guitars, washed-out guitars, shoegazy guitars, more or less. So when these guys get together, they're really trying to play against that in a very direct way. And I just think that's important context for what we're listening to here. Now, Lauren Mayberry has kind of an interesting backstory as well. She earned a four-year law degree and a separate journalism degree and had been working already for a few years as a music journalist and having some success with it, interviewing people like The Strokes and Kelly Rowland from Destiny's Child for a local music magazine in Glasgow while moonlighting in this band that ultimately goes to Ian Cook's home studio for help, right? Side note, that background of hers probably came in handy later because Churches basically blew up because of a hipster music blog.
Hmm. Nice work.
As a journalism major, I feel way inferior now that she also added a law degree and a singing career on top of that. So well done.
Now, being in your 20s is great. Having like a kind of a job and then moonlighting as a rock star at night or even just playing music at night.
Do you want to just pop that Billy Crystal monologue in here? We could just segue right to City Slickers. Kids, this is the best time of your life.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Cherish it. That's what makes me
think of. I'm such an old man. Jesus. Anyway, sorry.
So all this time, though, Ian Cook and Martin Daugherty have stayed friends, and they've been looking for something to do together. And they're relatively early in the process of making these synth-led demos. And after Cook has this chance meeting with Lauren Mayberry, they invite her over to sing on the demos. And as they tell it, they get together one evening at the house to try some vocals. And the three of them click instantly. And the band Churches is born of that trio. They never consider adding someone else. That's it. It cements right then and there. And by the way, damn. I mentioned earlier the name Churches. It's not a religious thing at all. I mean, it's Churches with a V, which is supposed to help them in terms of Googling, but the reality is Google autocorrects to the other word, which is much more right. common.
Well, the V thing always threw me off because I hadn't really heard their music before. I think I may have and not known it, but when I have come across the Churches with a V stylized that way, I just assumed it was some kind of goth band. Is that like a normal sort of gothy kind of thing?
I think I'm with you. There was something about the spelling that made me think that they were
like dark and sinister terrible. Or something.
Yeah, terrible. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes. So, no, you're not wrong. So the name is just supposed to be something that's powerful, that it has a lot of visual ideas around it. And the replaced V is a deliberate aid to making it not only searchable on Google, but also for their visual aesthetic, which really leans into these 45-degree angles that the V implies. But to your point, I also read that V is a subtle nod to a micro-genre of electronic music known as Witch House.
Which good. I'm glad we're here now.
Which is a Wikipedia page I visited this week, which uses a lot of occult symbols like triangles or some such nonsense. So you're not wrong. Right. The triangle is used in druid rituals.
All right, you're slowly winning me over here. I think we're
totally. I'm already on to Witch House. Can we talk about Witch House a little more?
That's a spinoff episode.
I couldn't bring myself to actually listen to anything in that genre, but yeah, I like the name of the genre. So another interesting detail, or we already mentioned it, right? This is their first foray themselves into synth-based music. They each have all these indie rock credentials. They're all individually guitar and keyboard players, and they don't have specific experience making music of this type at all. And even they all say, like, hey, most of the stuff we like is guitar-based rock. This was just a lark, basically.
That's crazy. And then it worked really well.
Well, the production level is pretty fantastic, given, you know, what you're saying here.
Mm-hmm. I did have to laugh when I looked at the personnel on the album, just like the Spinal Tap thing where they're playing that bass song and all of them are playing bass. If you look at the credits on Wikipedia, it's like four guys doing Pro Tools. And on Pro Tools tonight, Bob Smith, and on Pro Tools number two.
I read that initially their thinking was that Lauren would provide background vocals or sort of a counterpoint to Martin's vocals, a la Jenny Lewis and Ben Gibbard in the band The Postal Service, which you might know, another kind of electropop band that had some hits.
I kind of see that line. That definitely was a musical thread, I think I felt.
Yeah, and for the record, I actually think the Postal Service record is really, really good. I have listened to that semi-recently. But after a little bit of recording, Martin Daugherty, or maybe it was Ian Cook, sorry, I could be mixing that up, one of the men's singing as well. But then they basically just muted their own vocals on the playback and understood immediately that it was the right move to make Lauren Mayberry the lead.
She is the lead, right?
Good.
That's cool.
Call. So what happens next is really, truly an early 2010s kind of story. They finish their very first song called Lies, and they submit it to a synth-poppy hipster music blog that was around at the time called Neon Gold. This is in 2012. At the time, they're just thinking, hey, this is a studio project, maybe even just a one-off track, but it takes off all of a sudden. They're suddenly being hailed as a Scottish supergroup and getting passed around the internet. Now, I should probably mention kids and boomers too. Weirdly, both groups will not understand this. I think we're uniquely positioned maybe age-wise to understand what I'm about to say. You may not remember, but there was about a 10-year period where hipster music blogs were the way to get your music heard.
It is true. It is true.
In days long after mainstream radio airplay or even MTV airplay, but before Spotify editorial playlists, you had these indie blogs that had so much power in shaping the cultural music taste, at least for a subset.
It was in the heyday of Pandora on desktop and 99-cent iTunes single download.
Well, then you had these blogs that turned into more of, they would host perform, like, you know, like the Day Trotter sessions and things like that. Like there was,
oh yeah, Day Trotter was great. Yeah.
I found out a lot about a lot of bands back in the day from those channels, but you had to be really in it though, or you had to have people sharing stuff because it was just such a vast,
you couldn't find it. Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's a great point. And we already referenced Tiny Desk Concert, which is in a way the last remaining vestige of something like that, even though it's run by NPR, a huge organization. But you're right, Day Trotter was big, Blogotech, the French version was big.
It's really funny to hear that Lies was the first track, because I marked that as my least favorite, my low point on the album, because it's just monotonous and boring and sounds like a Gary Newman song, honestly. It sounds like Our Friends Electric from that early Gary Newman stuff. And I was like, wait, so.
I also think it's one of the worst songs on the final product. And so I didn't include it on our focus list. I neither think it's a highlight nor the true lowlight. So that's why I didn't put it on the list of songs we're going to talk about. But because, and so I am also genuinely surprised that that particular track got them as far as it did. But that's why I played it at the top, because it was so important to their career.
Sure.
So the song does really well off of that one blog post. It starts getting posted and repped by other blogs. Blogs like The Hype Machine was one of the big ones back then. And it starts getting some airplay on BBC Radio and on SoundCloud, which is still around, obviously, but it was sort of just starting then.
Yeah.
At this point, the band's never played a show, never really even thought about playing a show.
Jeez.
You know, they haven't planned for that at all. They did not plan for the success. Ian said in an interview that the response was frankly unbelievable and that they weren't all that committed to the band at that point, just messing around.
That's crazy.
But it takes off. What are you going to do, right?
Well, I think there's something to be said for when you have, not that when your guard is down, but when you're not coming in with defined expectations and you can kind of throw whatever you want together. There's probably a freeness about that that probably cultivates something that people might gravitate towards.
Absolutely. So we're going to start our synth pop side project later tonight, I assume.
Well, we're gonna have to look past synth pop, guys. We're going to have to look to the edge of the genre. Yeah, I don't know.
Witch House?
Yeah, there
that's
we go.
That's ripe for disruption.
Witch House is wide open.
Yeah, agreed. I will bring the projector if you could bring the Twin Peaks footage.
I'll bring the pointy hats.
Yes, okay. Please. I mean, I've been looking to join a cult for years, so.
It's your chance to start one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, don't join one. Come on, man, be original.
So, with all this buzz, I want to say too, but this is one of the reasons that they endeared themselves to me is learning this, especially for a guy like Ian Cook, who's now, by the time this record comes out, he's kind of in his late 30s, and it's a total surprise to him. So I thought that was cool.
That's crazy. A second chance. Yeah.
So they get all this buzz and there's pressure for them to play shows and they're nervous. So what do they do about it?
Drink.
They decide that before, well, they're Scottish, so of course they drink. They decide that before they go play a show for a bunch of A&R people, they need a couple practice gigs. So they book a couple nights at a local art school calling themselves Shark Week to avoid any press. So those are their first couple gigs, but
how'd those go?
No one important attends. Well, I guess they were good warm-ups because then they play, they get lots of label attention, and perhaps unsurprisingly, most of the press wants to focus on Lauren Mayberry, the young female lead singer, to put her front and center, to promote her as the leader of the band. But the band was really against this concept and strongly pushed for equality, including, of course, Lauren was pushing for this. They wanted to maintain their status as a true band, as a trio. I'm making this point because selling the band as led by a beautiful young woman clearly would have been a bit easier to do, but they very actively chose not to do that. And I'm including stuff like only being photographed all together and sort of with equal weight in the photograph, stuff like that.
Wow. Okay.
And, you know, these are the kinds of subtle, whether you realize it or not, these are the kinds of subtle things that the press and photographers are always kind of trying to do. I'm sure it's been in a few movies about bands where it's like, oh, just have them step away. We'll just get the lead singer here, you know, that kind of thing. And it not only creates tension within the band, but it creates a weird image for the fans.
Yeah. There's a feeling that like you're just part of the product, right? Because I know from experience.
Yeah. Phil's usually the eye candy and
the hot, young, sexy thing at the front of the stage. Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, in all of my smashingly successful musical projects, I was obviously the eye candy.
Well, yeah, I think it's also, it could have been unfair to her too, where there could be assumptions that she's the band leader, that she's, it could put a certain amount of pressure on her that wasn't good for anybody. And I don't know, No Doubt's backstory, but I think there was a little bit of that there where they were a band really. And then
absolutely,
clearly for obvious reasons, everyone gravitated towards her and, you know, she did it up, but yeah, I can see that.
And I want to compliment her in particular, because from reading interviews, listening to her speak about this time, she's the youngest member of the group. It takes a certain level of egolessness or selflessness to push away from that, right? In other words, I totally understand why someone like Gwen Stefani decided to lean into it for the betterment of getting her band press, getting their songs heard, and perhaps even some element of ego or selfishness mixed in there too. But that is totally understandable, to be honest. But it seems like Lauren Mayberry from the jump was like, nope, that's not how I want to do it. I don't want to be a pop star in that way. I want to be a part of this band that's an indie band, right? Luckily, they had some other demos in work, done or mostly done, when this thing took off. And later that year, they released some more singles, eventually an EP, while going out on tour, kind of to give fans a holdover until this album, their debut, which is called The Bones of What You Believe, dropped in September of 2013. So that is around 14 months after their song initially went viral on the blog. So they did pore over it in terms of the hours spent.
Yeah.
But speaking of hours spent, that brings us to our favorite segment of the podcast, By the Numbers. Okay, the first number I want to throw out at you guys is 13. I have already alluded to it, but that is the age difference in years between the oldest and youngest member of this band. Ian Cook is significantly older than the other two, and at the time the Church's record releases, he's 38, as I think I mentioned, while Lauren Mayberry is 25.
Wow.
Look, the older we get, the less that matters, but it matters a lot when you're 25.
I know.
For sure.
It definitely matters. It matters. And I remember being in bands in my early 20s, and I remember one band specifically, there was a guy who was a solid like 4 years younger than everybody else. Like, he was basically still a teenager, and everyone else was, you know, 23, 24. And even that, there was a big gulf just in the what you could depend on, what you could expect behaviorally. Like, that is definitely a big difference when you're trying to work on something very specific with other people.
Absolutely.
I think Spirit has them beat, though. What was that guy? Ed Cassidy, the drummer, was like 50, and the guitar player was like 17 or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, hilarious. So next number I want to throw out to you is 11. That's the number of major music publications that put this in their best of 2013 list. Put it in the best albums of 2013 list. I'm talking Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, Stereo Gum, NME, AV Club, and Paste Magazine, among others.
Damn.
Tough year for music. Damn.
That said, about 300,000 is the number of certified sales across the US and UK for this record, which, as we know, compared to records of old, is really not that many. But of course, we're in the era where people don't really buy music anymore. So the last number for you is 180 million. That's the streams for the lead single off this record sitting on Spotify right now. It has been a success, certainly by modern metrics, even though the album sales aren't there.
Damn.
Now, that said, we did hear via our text thread that Marty opened for these guys not too long ago. So,
oh, did he? I think I missed that.
Take it all with a grain of salt.
Wait. And he bailed out on this?
I don't know what to tell you, but that's what Marty said. He said he played in front of them at a street fair. Maybe he played at 1 p.m. and they played at 11 p.m. I'm not sure.
Maybe they were just walking by as he was playing like the kids stage or something like that. And that's so he played for them.
I was thinking he was maybe more like playing hacky sack at the church's show.
Maybe. You know, Marty will have to come on and defend that.
Yes.
That anecdote. But in any case, speaking of millions upon millions of streams, 1001 album complaints isn't quite there yet, but we're climbing that hill. We're making headway every single week. And that is thanks to you, dear audience. So thank you. Sincerely, we thank you. We get so excited to see the numbers go up each week, to hear from you and all the emails, the YouTube comments on Instagram. It really does mean a lot to us. So please know that just you listening to this forever free weekly show is supporting us and the hard work that all the boyos here are putting in week over week. Now, that said, if you're looking for other ways to support us, there are many great options. You can leave us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app. You could tell a friend about our show, a fellow complainer, or you can join our Patreon even just at the completely free level. That's right. You can join totally for free. You can sign on there. We can communicate more with you there. We're excited to start doing more listener request voting stuff and more advanced album commentary, soliciting some of those tweets before we do the show over on the free feed of the Patreon. Now, that's in addition to the cool bonus shows we're doing at the $5 a month tier, like Song Battle. So, point is, help us out any way you're able to. We love you for it. Okay, with that background context out of the way, shall we talk about some of these songs, gents?
Dude, let's get into it.
Sure, yeah.
I am pumped.
First song we have on the focus list is also the first song on the album. It's called The Mother We Share. I saw in one interview that they cited Laurie Anderson as an influence. Shout out to Song Battle March Radness, where Marty attempted to submit an avant-garde pop song as the best song of the 80s. But anyway, I think you can actually hear some of that influence on this track with that echoey, clipped vocal thing. I think that's the type of thing they're talking about.
Yeah, like the arpeggio bouncing around in the beginning.
Yep.
Totally. And I do think as like a sort of song one, track one, I know we've already covered, you know, that they had a single before this, but like the track one, album one situation, like it's a compelling opening moment.
Totally.
Sure.
You know, like it definitely catches your attention.
Yeah. I alluded to this earlier. This is definitely going on the list for me as a song, as a takeaway. And so maybe I'll slightly retract my nothing memorable part because this is a good one. And I do enjoy coming away from these with at least one song that's now in the bank. It's a total slam dunk. And there's a lot of little details that I like, especially coming out of the intro. I feel like they hit you with this like artificial halftime kind of thing because there's a so you're expecting this really high tempo thing. And it's almost like you get a manufactured drop within the first 10 seconds of the song. I think it works really well. And I think there's a lot of those little things. Total slam dunk of a song, in my opinion.
And they already start at the beginning, start playing with dynamics too. That intro, like you said, the first 10, 15 seconds, it's all in. It's a wall of synths. And then it drops out and you've got some nice rhythmic play in there with the lyrics and the silence. It's a great track.
I agree. And this is the first single off the official album, even though they had released, they kind of got famous off of that other track. But when it came time to finish the album, this is the single they put out. This is the one that had all those streams on Spotify. And I do think it's a great track. It's a very successful track. I wanted to mention, in addition to what you all said, I don't think of them necessarily as amazing lyrics writers, nor do I think the point of this music is necessarily lyrics. But I think the title here creates a nice image. I like it.
Yeah, agreed.
It's lyrically one of the stronger efforts, and it makes me feel something. I can't quite put my finger on it.
Absolutely. I found myself searching for a little more meaning in the lyrics than maybe I found. Again, maybe if I kept listening, I'd find it. But this was obviously a great song, and I hear what you're saying about like the hook line, and again, it's just compelling. It feels like there's something tangible there.
Yeah.
One of the things that stuck out to me lyrically was, right, the idea of how can I approach what I'm trying to say, which is a song about a sibling, and titling it and singing about the mother we share, which I thought was very cool. But it took me back to the way the Police did that thing with Don't Stand So Close to Me. Like, what is the most abstract way you could talk about this relationship that you shouldn't be in? Don't stand so close to me. Like, that's wild. And this I thought was kind of on that level of really just pivoting to a completely different angle, which is very cool.
Yeah. It feels like a fresh take on an old concept. I agree with that.
Yeah. And I also like this might not have been their intent, but I feel like the whole idea of the mother we share, there's like a unifying, broader, all in this together in the world kind of thing, which again, might not have been at all what they were going for, but I think it has that overarching, you know, kind of vibe.
You are such a fucking hippie.
We're all children of Mother Earth and Gaia.
Wait, how many fish shows have you been to, Phil?
Like 30.
Boosh.
Well, just to follow up on some of our criticisms from earlier that will reappear, I did read that they really agonized over this track and specifically trying to strip away ideas to let the song breathe more and give it more of that dynamic range. And so I think that really paid off for them. It makes perfect sense that this is the first song, that this is the first single. I mean, we always say, yeah, of course it makes sense. If you know what your best song is, put it first, release it as a single. But that doesn't always happen, or bands don't always seem to know that. So they did it here. It's great.
I did have one complaint.
Sure.
Which was the millennial yodel is a trope that we've seen Katy Perry, Kesha, Lorde. It's the whatever it is. And sure, they do that within the first, which is catchy. I'm not faulting them for it, but it definitely, I heard that, I was like, millennial yodel.
She like opens with it. She like synthesizes it, right?
Yeah, right.
It does work.
It's catchy. It works. It just annoys me personally. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't really bump me, but feels like classic, relatively classic pop to me. It works. Okay, let's move on to the next song. This one is called Gun.
Far.
this is where I started really getting a bit frustrated. I don't know if it's arpeggiation, what the button is, but whatever goes.
That's arpeggiation. Yeah, yeah.
It's, I mean.
Yeah. Awesome is the word you're looking for. Awesome is the word.
It's awesome, like the way that salt is awesome. And but like if you eat an entire container of salt, you're gonna die.
Yes. Well, did you guys feel though that part of my coming around on the record was stripping it down to the focus list? I know we complain so often about having to listen for 40 whole minutes or an hour or whatever it might be, but stripping it down to these five songs and a 20-minute EP length hit, this made me like it more.
Alan, I hear what you're saying loud and clear about like how there are a handful of like real bangers on that album, and then there's a lot of like, they're not bad songs, but they're kind of just there, right? And there are just certain songs where the synth compositions are significantly more successful, even though the production level is there for all of them. Like the melodies are there for all of them. Some of the songs are just much more successful. This song in particular, it's not that for me there's any, I had any beef with this song, although it just didn't really do it for me. This is the beginning of like the repetition, though. There's another song on the focus list. It's actually the next one on the focus list where it's like you start to hear the same sounds and the same, like, you know, you're using the synthesizer as a drum machine sometimes, and like, you know, bugga-da-guck, 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 bugga-da-guck.
Part of my issue with this era of synth pop is that music is cyclical, and we talked about this with the Amy Winehouse episode, which actually also might have been the origin of the Novocaine jaw that you refer to, Adam, or the slack jaw thing.
Right, right.
But the idea that they're trying to do this retro thing, and I think it might have been Rob that was like, I'd rather just listen to the retro thing and not this derivative product. And it's kind of how I felt about this song, where I couldn't stop thinking I was listening to like a Cyndi Lauper song, and I just came to the conclusion that why don't I just listen to that, because this isn't, it didn't feel like additive to me. It just felt like, okay, it's a callback to this old school sound, but I didn't sense any sort of like modern twist on it or anything that took it above just a nostalgic, you know, sort of throwback.
First of all, how dare you throw my own words back at me from a previous podcast?
Now. I don't even know if you said that. I might have made up that you even said that, but it sounds like something you would say.
I think it's a successful song. It's not really even amongst my three favorite songs on the album. So I agree with the general critique that the album gets samey at a point. But I also tried to pick the songs that I thought had the strongest melodies, or even better yet, the sense of rhythmic interplay or counter melody. So to me, this one did stand out in that sense. I think it's a successful song, and I thought it had an interesting hook line. I'd never heard someone express that in that way.
Alan, you're our resident bass player on the call. At any point on this album, were you tempted to go pick up the bass and play along? Because I know the bass is all synth, and it's probably programmed, but I loved listening along and even grabbed my bass off the wall to try to play along. And I suck, so I can't do those fast, like, you know, 16th and 32nd notes. But like, was there anything compelling about the bass where you wanted to go play along, or was it not funky enough? Or
honestly, I never even gave a thought to the bass on this album. And I think it's because, I don't know if it's all synth bass or if they had an actual electric string bass happening. And I'm not against like synth bass, actually. I can get into like that old, the Stevie Wonder, the Greg Phelan-Gaines, Chaka Khan stuff.
Right, the Seinfeld theme.
Yeah, totally, you know, the classics. So I'm not like against that necessarily, but there might've just been so much happening that it didn't feel like it was like driving the song in a way that hooked me.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot going on.
It is a little busy. It is a little busy. I would agree. This song definitely does not breathe as much. This arrangement doesn't, that is. Let's move it along to the next song we're going to talk about, which is called Under the Tide. Watching you run from the sidelines. Taking a breath, filling your lungs, keeping you alive. No fear.
Head up, keep holding you. Head up,
Not only did you remove your most recognizable distinctive weapon in Lauren Mayberry's voice, but you also gave Martin Daugherty a really dull, flat melody to sing. It builds, 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 and it gets no payoff. I understand the payoff is supposed to be at 90 seconds in-ish, 127-ish, but that's not enough to justify what I've just sat through.
You also put it right after the hit that everybody presumably bought the record for, that they already knew, right?
Yeah.
You're really setting them up for success.
It was the end of the first side also. So they very purposely sequenced the album and put Martin's vocals as the lead on the two side enders. I don't think there was really any good reason to do that, honestly, but they did very actively think about
this. This felt to me like when you go see a show and occasionally the tech has to come up and play a few riffs in order to make sure the guitar is working and that the sound check. You're just like, why the fuck do I gotta listen to this guy? Or if you go to WWE back in the day and you're expecting Hulk Hogan and you just watch a bunch of jobbers wrestling, you're just like, what?
Eric Smith. What? Who's this guy?
I like how Alan outs himself as a WWE fan. Did you say jobbers? Was that even a word?
Oh, yeah. The jobbers were the guys who would come out and lose on the Saturday morning CBS or ABC 10 o'clock. The ones that I could watch because I didn't have cable.
Man. Guys, when is the wrestling podcast? I got to get my knowledge up. When can I just sit in?
To your point, I do feel sympathy for this guy, Martin. This guy fronted bands in the past. He was a little bit of a journeyman in the same way that any of us would think of ourselves that way. And suddenly he's in a band with a far superior singer who is their weapon in the band. And he feels like he has to take a backseat. He's probably even writing a fair amount of the melodies. All the songs are credited to all three of them. But they all contributed, so I understand where he's coming from, but ultimately, it's a letdown.
I don't feel bad for him, because I feel like if you find yourself in this position, I'm going to guess you've already taken a healthy dose of ego death now at some point, you know, in the past. So
is that a licensed pharmaceutical that we can buy?
I don't know, but it's definitely not street legal. And so I think he probably feels great about this. He's got to be excited to just be in the game in this in a major way.
Fair enough.
I'm going to swoop in and defend this song. So her voice, while I love it, it at points got to the Geddy Lee thing where she has such a high register that 4-5 songs in, it was getting a little bit much. So I actually saw this as the Nothing Else Matters spot where, like, okay, I could finally just like relax,
go to the bathroom, get a beer.
Exactly. Right. All right. Point taken.
You know, now that you phrase it that way, Adam, there is something sonically at the beginning of the song with the, like, the drum machine where it almost sounds like it's like EQ'd out a little bit. Like, it's in my notes. Does this sound lo-fi on purpose? And to that end, yeah, maybe it is like a purposefully sonic break. You're not getting annihilated by the low end, high end thing in the same way.
It's a good point, and I was feeling something similar, but I thought the track before this called Tether was supposed to be the cool down track that made you want the dance music again. This felt just a little dance music-y stock to me.
Yeah, it pumps pretty hard by the end.
Listen, it's not unpleasant to listen to, ultimately, sure, for me, but it's just missing the pop, pun intended, of their best tracks.
Well, and the way it's situated in the album and what you've come to expect, I like when bands do the multiple singers thing if they do it well, but it's got to be, I'm not saying you have to have exact equal distribution, but it can't be 12 songs of one person and then you come in with this milquetoast entry.
Random one-off.
I'm not saying you have to seize the day and steal the show, but if you are going to come in, I just think it should offer a little bit more.
It should be for a good reason. No, I totally agree with you. And we're going to talk about a song coming up that has them both singing that I think is successful. But first, let's move on to the next song. It's called Recover. Cut.
Sleep.
like this one in part because I think you can hear Lauren, the vocalist, pushing her voice a little bit and getting a little more emotion in the vocal, especially in the chorus. And I really like the melody in the chorus. I think it might be my favorite single melody on the record, even though this song is not my favorite.
I think this likely was my favorite song.
I got vibes of Paramore in this. And I love, I forget her last, Haley, whatever her last name is, the singer from Paramore. And she's a rock singer and she pushes, but she's in that same register. And you're right. On this one, I also watched a live version where she's giving it some energy. She's putting some ass behind her voice and it rocks live.
I think the build really worked on this one too. It's another example of simple melody, simple chords, but they ring a nice song arc out of it. And there's a tonal and melodic change that happens around 50 seconds that is particularly really nice. But there, I just want to point out, there's a lot of subtlety here in what they do and how they do it. Like shifting the vocal cadence across sections, adding little pieces, just slightly busier hi-hats and pushing them to the front of the mix a little more to give it a change when there's really not that much changing.
Just like a, just a little taste of Fleetwood Mac, you know? It's like all Stevie Nicks really does is come in on a different beat, but it sounds totally different. You're like, how'd you do that? And she's like, I came in on the two.
Yeah, it's a great pop trick. If you, I've heard people say that if you start the verse on the one, then you have to start the chorus on the end, you know? And that's just how it works.
This was the song that, in a weird way, I really liked this song. This was my favorite song on the record, as I mentioned. This was the song that, like, I asked myself, if I was 20 years younger, this call was happening 20 years in the future, and all of the songs were her, right? Like, would I feel the same way about this as I did, like, the Alanis Morissette record? Like, there was just something in this that, like, I don't know. It's like, I didn't totally understand the story, but it felt like it, like, connected physically or something. And I just, I don't know. It just, like, helped me imagine. There was, like, this created some imagination for me. If I had had a different experience and the passage of time, could I feel different about this? And I think the answer is definitely yes.
Sure. Fair enough. Well, let's round it out, gents, by talking about the last song on our focus list.
Wait, before we jump to the last song, I have a question. It's more of like a visual art question. I'm curious if this came up. I noticed, and what brings it up is just like looking at the list and in our like Spotify focus list, or the art rather. I know you said they're like a visual group. Is there any notation on like why this art sort of looks like the radioactive symbol? Like, that was purposeful.
Like the biohazard?
Yeah, totally. But it doesn't seem to fit, but like that obviously had to be purposeful.
It calls to that, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think of that when I looked at it, but you're right. That has a connection to that. What I read was the thing about the occult. The
triangles.
And triangles, yeah.
And three. There's a lot of three. Everybody knows three is a powerful number.
Very spooky number.
Rule of threes. Everything's spooky.
Let's keep it moving along. Last song on the focus list is called Night Sky. This is my favorite track. I thought this was a fist-pumping anthem of a song. This is the one that made me most feel like Katy Perry could have done this song. I mean that in the best possible way. I think it's a fun song. And I think it's another one where the production, the underlying beats and synths are allowed to breathe and it feels a little bit groovy. It's cool.
This almost feels like it could be a real drummer in there.
They might actually have a drummer in their some of their live shows, I think. So there, it could be drums in the actual studio, because I agree, it's bigger than it feels that you could achieve from drum machines. But
yeah, there's just like a space to some of the like kick snare stuff.
So Night Sky on Wikipedia is listed as one of the tracks that actually has a drummer by the name of Johnny Scott. who did drums on track 3 and 8. Now, I don't know, drum programming or drums, I don't know. But
sounds like it could be real drums, heavily processed, right? On Night Sky, you're saying, like, yeah, you can sort of get the feel real drums vibe. I think I like things that breathe a little more. I like, I'm just not as into synth pop, and that's the space, right? That's my personal taste.
But to me, this was the good use of Martin Daugherty's vocal, the kind of call and response between them. I think it's a great, it literally made me want to pump my fist in the air at a certain point. And that's saying something.
I know. That's great.
Even though I didn't care for the song all that much, the comment I made earlier where if you know what you're going for and you land it, to me, you did your job. And I think they do it here where it's clear what they're going for. And I think it works for that purpose. Even if I didn't find it like anything special to it, I think it was a pretty good example of them, what they would feel is their best.
And this is one of those songs that really, I'm embarrassed to say it, but it was in the basement, kind of, Rob, like you were saying, working out, right? This is actually good workout music.
Oh, yeah.
So I was in the basement and I had this cranked with a subwoofer. And there is something about that thumping bass that you just don't get with a little Bluetooth speaker or your earbuds, and it pumps you up. It's really one of those things. I feel like the sound and the experience helped with, well, this song and the whole album.
Okay, we've gabbed quite enough about this record. I think it's time to render our official verdict. Is The Bones of What You Believe a must listen? I'm going to throw it first to Adam.
We've said it before with newer albums. It's very hard to judge it in the same way that we would judge something that is innovating a style, innovating a sound from the 60s, 70s, or even 80s. And while this may sound recycled at times, I think the songwriting is good. I think this holds up. I loved this album, and I'm going to say, yes, you need to listen to it.
Awesome. One correct vote logged. Now on to Alan.
I'll cut the suspense and say I'm going to be an incorrect vote. No, I try to be open-minded about this stuff, and I will say that I have evolved my position in light of the context. I've evolved it from feeling about it to feeling like, okay, I get what they're trying to do. I have some more respect for the group. I just don't think it rises to essential. There are aspects that are fun. There's elements that I like and constituent parts. But to put this in front of somebody and say, you have to listen to this before you die, I don't think it's there. So it's a no for me.
Okay. What say you, Phil?
So unfortunately, I'm going to have to side with Alan here. For me, it just comes down to the essentialness. I liked many of the songs on this record. That's the right way to put it. I think some of them were, you know, sort of furniture, for lack of a better word. But like lots of songs are furniture. Like that's the way it goes. This was significantly more successful than, you know, much of what I hear that's new. But I don't think it rises to essential. I think there are better executions of this sort of thing. But it was quite enjoyable. But that's a no.
Okay. Got it. Wasn't sure. Okay. Well, this is Rob here. And it's a little bit of a squeaker, even though I very much enjoyed the record. I vacillated even throughout tonight's conversation. But I am going to give it a yes, because it is a confident debut that goes against the grain of what was happening at the time, at least in that locale, and achieves its goal, which is anthemic pop music. Memorable pop music made outside of the pop music machine. And I think it's important. I agree, because it's so modern, you can't trace its lineage. You can't really say what it has influenced exactly yet. And so that makes it hard to call it essential. I get that part of it, and I feel that. However, I think it's worthwhile to check in on pop music and other genres you don't care so much about occasionally. And I wish more pop music had this much thought put into it. So.
Now, Rob, for new listeners, what happens in the event of a tie?
Oh, the tie goes to the runner being the artist. We're going to pass you on through, Churches. Congratulations. You're
nice.
In it, baby. You're on the list of essential albums. Congratulations.
So does this go on their Wikipedia page that they won this award?
I've hacked the Wikipedia page. I will now be a contributor.
I'm busy updating the Witch House Wikipedia page. Okay, I think there's two things left to do here before we end the show this evening. One, Mike's going to stay with me, thankfully, because I love talking. And we're going to dip our hands in the old mailbag. So,
nice.
Let's do that now. Scott, the college history professor, writes in. He says, "You used yet another excellent word recently, but expressed trepidation that some smart-ass professor would call you out on the pronunciation. Hagiography. Hold on. Professor Smartass on the line here. I think you said it with a hard G. It's a soft G. Sorry. The origin of the word is actually Catholic. Lives of saints were known as hagiographies, and the word later came to mean any fawning biography of, oh, I don't know, say, Leonard Cohen." But alas, before I, Rob, was able to respond to this peremptory critique, Scott wrote back and corrected himself.
The self-boosh.
Oh, damn.
Saying, "Damn, I checked, and you were right, buddy. Hagiography is in fact pronounced with a hard G. To the victor go the spoils."
Wow, God.
See, after the first half of that, I was going to use that as my excuse for why I didn't know the word when it was first dropped, because you were mispronouncing it.
But. You can imagine my thrill in getting both of those emails simultaneously when I check the inbox. But thank you, Scott, a.k.a. Professor Smartass. Please continue to write in and keep all of us honest when it comes to pronunciation and etymology. I love it. Vocabulary is fun, right?
Nice.
Okay. And then I have some collected feedback from our Abbey Road episodes, as promised from last week. And I'm proud to say the Abbey Road episodes broke all our records for downloads here at the show. So thank you all for that.
Very cool.
Listener Jay writes in, "I just discovered your podcast and I want to say what great listening your shows are. I love its eclecticism, especially as I love all genres of music. There's so much back recordings to listen to. I'm very excited. On Abbey Road, I can't disagree with anything you guys say about it."
Yeah.
Well, great. End of email.
Thanks. Bye.
He says, "She's So Heavy, in my opinion, is the best the Beatles ever sounded. And I recently found out it was the last song they ever recorded together. If only we could have found out what direction they would have gone from there."
Hmm.
Hard to disagree with that. I certainly wonder, as does the world. Listener Martin writes in, "It was interesting to hear your views on Abbey Road. Some info you might not have been aware of." This is a little sad face coming up, guys.
Uh-oh.
"Yoko Ono miscarried in late November 1968. Oh. John was obviously very concerned, even to the extent that he slept on the floor of her hospital room. And it was around this time he got into heroin as a way of coping. So he was very protective of Yoko to the extent that she sat in on the Let It Be film sessions about a month and a half later. And then, of course, she was in the hospital bed during the Abbey Road sessions a few months after that. The other Beatles, of course, knew this, and that's why little was said. Yeah, it was strange, but they were very young guys coping with new scenarios."
I didn't know that. That definitely sheds some light.
And I feel like a dick.
A difficult context, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally shed some light. Did not know that.
That doesn't mean she needed to scream on that Chuck Berry set like many years later. So you don't get a lifetime pass.
We could still hate her for that.
That particular piece of evidence will be rescinded, but not other pieces of evidence like Alan just mentioned. And lastly, I wanted to read one from Jack, an expat American living in London. He writes, "Currently sitting in a bookstore on the King's Road in Chelsea, listening to the pod. I wasn't aware of the tweet length review comment offer in time, but for side two of Abbey Road, my comment is the greatest band of all time. Bids adieu with the greatest side of any album ever."
My man.
It's pretty good.
Nice. That is solid.
Thank you all. If you want to tell us anything that's on your mind, why we're right, why we're wrong, or any other detail, piece of context that we may have missed, please do. We love to hear from you. Write us at 1001albumcomplaints@gmail.com. Okay, and there is one piece of business left. And
they, Rob, it's staying with you.
It's staying with me.
I've talked stuff.
I've used up all my words for the week here. But it continues. The Albinator is, of course, in my possession. It is dancing to the synth bass as the strobe lights entrance it in the corner of a darkened room. So let's give that bad boy a spin and see what we're going to be listening to this week. Without further ado, our homework for next week is the album is called Dig Me Out, and the band is Slater Kinney.
Okay.
I definitely know Slater Kinney, but yeah, I'm not super familiar with this record, or maybe I am.
It's girl punk, Riot Girl.
Yeah. Girl punk, for sure.
Carrie Brownstein, who is also correct, of Portlandia, a semi-famous actress. I couldn't name a lick of their music, but I've seen their name around a bit.
Yes, I think they were innovators early on in a scene. So excited to get into that, listen to that. You should listen along with us, dear listeners, and join us next week for Slater Kinney, Dig Me Out. For everyone here at the podcast this week, I have been Rob.
I'm Alan.
I'm Adam.
And I am Phil.
Boosh.